From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Scientists in Oregon have developed a technique that could be used to prevent certain genetic diseases. They've demonstrated it in monkeys and are now eager to try it in people. But the technique raises ethical questions because, as NPR's Richard Harris reports, it makes a permanent genetic change not just in an individual, but in all generations that follow.
You need to know just a bit of biology before you can understand what these guys are doing. Most of our genes are in our chromosomes, which are in the cell's inner sanctum, the nucleus. But 37 human genes are outside the nucleus. They are contained in tiny bodies called mitochondria, which float around in our cells. Mitochondria are the mini power plants for our cells, and mutations in the genes inside mitochondria can cause disease. Shukrat Mitalipov and his colleagues at Oregon Health and Science University are trying to figure out how to treat this class of rare genetic diseases. They've been working with eggs of rhesus monkeys. If you fix a genetic problem in an egg, you'll fix it in all the cells the egg grows into, the whole animal.
So basically, we construct this experimental egg, which will contain, you know, nuclear genes from one female, but mitochondria genes from another female.
In short, they can remove the nucleus from an egg that has defective mitochondrial genes and put it into an egg that has healthy mitochondria. So the mother's chromosomes end up in an egg that has healthy mitochondria, albeit from a different female. And the technique worked quite well in monkeys, according to a study Nature magazine has published online. The researchers made this transfer with 15 eggs, fertilized them, and ended up with 4 baby monkeys.
So what we showed is these manipulated eggs behave like a normal eggs, and most importantly, they resulted in births of healthy offspring.
The monkeys are only a few months old so far. It will take 4 or 5 years before the scientists know whether they are able to reproduce successfully, and it could take even longer to notice any long-term health effects. Mitalipov says he doesn't want to wait that long. He wants to try the technique in people. To do that, he would need to convince the Food and Drug Administration that the technique is safe, and he will also have to deal with a key ethical issue. Art Kaplan at the University of Pennsylvania says the issue is that modifying eggs means that the change doesn't merely affect one individual.
It goes on forever because it's passed on from generation to generation.
This kind of manipulation is called germline therapy, and it's been considered taboo. For one thing, if there are health risks, they will affect multiple generations. For another, it could open the door to genetically engineering a lineage of people with supposedly superior qualities. This is called eugenics, and many people find that repugnant. So Kaplan says the proposal to try this technique in humans deserves special attention.
It does breach the principle. No germline engineering. It breaches a promise that many geneticists have made that whatever else, they're not going down that road. I always thought that promise would be difficult to keep. This particular experiment shows why.
Kaplan argues the egg manipulation in this case isn't seeking to make an improved person, just a healthy one, and he's okay with that. But George Annis at Boston University is uneasy, both for ethical reasons and for practical ones.
I don't think anything should necessarily be totally off the table, although this would be pretty extreme. This would certainly be at that end that I would probably have a presumption it shouldn't be done, and the burden of proof would be on the people who are proposing it to show that it's safe and that it's not going to create problems, not just for the children, but for the children's children.
And he says it will take a lot more than just 4 apparently healthy baby monkeys to make that case. Richard Harris, NPR News.
When writer Lizzie Skernick missed seeing the movie Jaws as a girl, she was disappointed to miss out on all the gory action. But then she snagged a copy of The Steamy Paperback by Peter Benchley and found she was way more interested in cataloging the dirty words than whether they'd catch that killer shark. So she's here to talk about Jaws for our series My Guilty Pleasure, in which writers tell us about the books they're embarrassed to love.
You're supposed to feel guilty when you secretly like the movie of a book better than the book itself. But in the case of Jaws, a book I read and reread long before I was allowed to see the film, I'm far more embarrassed to admit I prefer the novel. Because while Jaws the movie is a bone-chilling update on Moby Dick, Jaws the novel is more like Peyton Place by the sea. Everyone swears like a sailor, and the hunt for the shark comes a very distant second to a bunch of hot summer trysts. Take Police Chief Martin Brody, the likable family man played by Roy Scheider in the movie. He's haunted by all the deaths he could have prevented. But in the book, he's also a frustrated cuckold whose unsatisfied wife is noodling around with a handsome ichthyologist. In the film, a chattery Richard Dreyfuss gets to live. But in the book, suavely seductive Matt Cooper gets eaten alive. And since you've seen exactly what he did to Brody's wife in a hotel a few chapters earlier, you know he totally deserves it. I'm also secretly addicted to Benchley's skill with the well-placed obscenity. Sure, now we're used to a few R-rated bombs dropped in prime time, but even 35 years ago, Benchley would have put your average episode of The Sopranos to shame. I've never seen profanity so exquisitely arranged or so frequently flung out, like ladlefuls of bloody chum. The filthiest tongue of all belongs to salty sea dog Quint, who's not only an expert on the hunt, but a true master of the filthy riposte. His frequent eruptions fill me with a naughty thrill, especially the line he lets loose with when he sees a full frontal of the shark. Hint, it's not "we're gonna need a bigger boat." I finally saw the movie version of Jaws, and I have to give it to Spielberg. It worked. I'm still scared to wade out past my knees. But I'm perfectly happy to sit on the shore and crack open the paperback. Unlike the scary scenes in the movie, when you get to the good parts of this book, you don't have to cover your eyes.
Lizzie Skernick is the author of Shelf Discovery, a memoir of teen reading. You'll find more My Guilty Pleasures at the new NPR.org.
Republican Party Chairman Michael Steele is making proposals on health care. He wrote in the Washington Post that he opposes a government-run health care system. His party has attacked government involvement in health care all summer. That rhetoric is complicated by something else Steele wants to do, as part of what he calls a Bill of Rights for seniors. Chairman Steele writes, quote, "We need to protect Medicare and not cut it in the name of health insurance reform." Democratic health care plans assume big savings by reworking the government's Medicare program for seniors. When we sat down with Steele early this week, we asked what he wants to do with Medicare.
What makes it a valuable program is that it is the last line of opportunity to receive health care for a lot of our seniors, and it has been now for since the 1960s. The problem is, as we all note, that the system has been raided over the years from time to time. It's become bloated, and in some cases, its efficiencies have not been maxed out. Therefore, it's running into problems where, you know, every few years we're having stories about Medicare falling apart, and you know, we've already projected it's going to be out of money.
It's going to run out of money.
Years. Exactly.
So, but you're coming here against reducing the spending on Medicare,
Medicare. Well, no, that's not coming out against reducing the spending. That is not, I mean, that's a wonderful interpretation by the left, but what I was saying was don't go raiding the program without some sense of what we're taking from the program, the impact it's going to have on the senior citizens out there. You know, raiding this a program that's already bankrupt to pay for another program that we can't afford is not good public policy.
So you would be in favor of certain Medicare cuts?
Absolutely. You want to maximize the efficiencies of the program. I mean, anyone who's in the program would want you to do that, and certainly those who manage it would want you to do that.
Here's another thing that I'm trying to figure out. Within a couple of paragraphs of writing, "We need to protect Medicare," you write that you oppose President Obama's, quote, "plan for a government-run health care system."
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're a veteran public policy official. You're aware that Medicare is a government-run health care
program. Yeah, look how it's run. And that's my point. Take Medicare and make it writ large across the country, because here we're now. How many times have we been to the precipice of bankruptcy for a government-run health care program?
It sounds like you don't like Medicare very much at all, but
no,
you
I'm
write in this op-ed that,
look,
that you
Medicare...
want to protect Medicare
because it's politically popular.
People like Medicare. That's why you're writing to protect Medicare.
People may like Medicare, and liking a program and having it run efficiently is sometimes two different things. And the reality of it is simply this. I'm not saying I like or dislike Medicare. It is what it is. It is a program that has been around for over 40 years. And in those 40 years, it has not been run efficiently and well enough to sustain itself. You have Medicare, you have Amtrak, you have the post office, all these government-run agencies that try to inject themselves into private markets typically don't do too well. My only point is that, okay, Medicare is what it is. It's not going anywhere. So let's focus on fixing it so that we don't every 3, 5, 10 years have discussions about bankruptcy and running out of money.
I'm still having a little trouble with the notion that you're going to write that you're going to protect Medicare, that you're going to preserve this program to make sure that this government-run health care system stays solid in the long term. And yet you are opposing, quote, government-run health care.
Wait a minute. Just because, you know, I want to protect something that's already in place and make it run better and run efficiently for the senior citizens that are in that system does not mean that I want to automatically support, nationalizing or creating a similar system for everybody else in the country who currently isn't on Medicare.
Let me ask another question here, because you warned that some of the health care proposals out there would, quote, create government boards that would decide what treatments would or would not be funded. And you want that decision to be between the doctor and the patient. When a private insurance company pays now, what is your impression of who decides what that private insurance company is going to cover? Is that purely between the doctor and the patient now?
Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. It depends on the type of treatment and the medicines that are at stake. And I've had the same experience my own self where I've needed a certain type of medication, and it, you know, the insurance company is like, well, you can have it, but we'll only pay for this amount or this portion. I don't like that any more than I like the government do it. And my point is, you know, if the government's going to do it, it's going to do it 10 times worse, and it's going to be more pronounced than the private insurers. And I think that's a feature that we can fix right now. And sure, there are issues in the insurance market that we can regulate a little bit better and that we can control better to maximize the benefits to the consumers. That's something that, yeah, we can rightly reform and fix.
You would trust the government to look into that?
No, I'm talking about citizens.
That's something that should be looked into.
Who regulates the insurance markets?
That would be the government, I believe.
And so, wait a minute, hold up. You're doing a wonderful little dance here and you're trying to be cute, but the reality of this is very simple. I'm not saying the government doesn't have a role to play. I've never said that. The government does have a role to play. The government has a very limited role to play.
Mr. Chairman, I respect that you feel that I'm doing a dance here. I just want you to know that as a citizen, I'm a little confused by the positions you take because you're giving me a very nice, nuanced position here.
It's not nice and nuanced. I'm being very clear.
You're giving me, nevertheless, a nuanced position.
What's nuance? What don't you understand?
What nuance means is you're not doing it absolutely black and white. You're saying you recognize the government has a role to play here. But when
Wait a minute, is that not reality? Come to the
actual rhetoric, it seems more along the lines of absolutes.
I don't accept your premise, and you know you have your view, and you can see it as nuanced all you want. But the reality of it is,
I'm not saying nuanced is a bad thing.
I'm being very clear. I want to have an open debate. I want to put ideas out there. I want the people to understand what this is going to look like when it's all said and done. And I'm not trying to be nuanced. I'm not trying to be cute. I'm trying to be very clear. I'm not saying the government doesn't have a role to play here. It does. It's managing a Medicare program, so it has a role to play.
Maybe we're getting hung up on the word nuanced. Maybe I should say complicated. Do you find it challenging to get into this complicated debate and explain things to people in a way that it's honest to the facts and still very clear and
That's
doesn't just
point.
Kind of scare people with sound bites?
Well, no. Look, no one's trying to scare people with sound bites. I mean, you know, I've not done that, and I don't know any of the leaders in the House and the Senate that have done that. And so, yeah, it's complicated, and you want to break it down. I remember when Reg D came in, and all the things that my sister, who's a doctor, and I am a lawyer, had to do with my parents to sit down to help them understand exactly what this meant, what forms they had to fill out, et cetera, et cetera. It was
Regulation
D was the prescription drug program that was put into place under the Bush administration.
Okay.
And the reality of it was complicated, and it was confusing. We try to make it as straightforward as we can without getting into a lot of the nitty-gritty stuff that, you know, the minutia, if you will. But you've got to do it. You've got to deal with both ends of that spectrum, and we try to do that every day. And I think through the Senior Healthcare Bill of Rights, this was one way for us to try to do that.
Mr. Chairman, enjoy the time. Thanks
very
much.
All right, thank you.
Michael Steele is the National Republican Party chairman. Another story about celebrity real estate is today's last word in business. If you don't mind tight quarters, you might want to check out a house in downtown Manhattan's West Village. It's the skinniest house in the city, and it's for sale. This three-story home, built in 1873, measures 8.5 feet across on the inside. That means if you were to lay down, stretch out your arms, there's a good chance that you might be able to at least get close to touching both walls at once. You will find a little more space by going down into the finished basement through the trap door in the kitchen. Now, there is an aura of famous people to this sliver of real estate. The anthropologist Margaret Mead once lived in it. Edna St. Vincent Millay may have penned a poem in this narrow home, which is now selling for a very plump price of $2.75 million. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.